Welcome to Holden Village. In the fireside room, today's speaker is Greg Bowman, and he will be doing a session entitled Reading Myths, Wild Kingdoms, and Other Worlds. So, let's listen in on Greg.
Today we're going to talk about beast fables and fantasies, which aren't normally put together into the same group. It's just that I think of these this kind of literature in terms, in opposite terms of the kind that we talked about on Monday, which was literature that essentially has kids in everyday situations doing everyday things. Beast fables. We'll start with beast fables. These are the way that I define a beast fable is essentially a work that is about animals and uses animals in an anthropomorphic way. Big word. You guys know what anthropomorphism is?
Anthro is anthropology.
Which is what?
What's anthropology?
Ants or something.
Good try.
Good guess.
Yeah. Anthro from the Greek word for
humanity.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Yeah. This is something that this is. Essentially giving human characteristics to a beast. Can you think of an example maybe from movies recently?
Any Disney film.
Yeah. Did you see The Lion King?
Yeah.
Okay, anthropomorphism. How often do you see a lion talk?
In real life. Oh, that would be Homeward Bound too.
Homeward Bound? Right, exactly.
Like one of the dogs.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the type of thing. Giving human characteristics to animals. Let me ask you, why do you think it's important to write this way, to write about animals in terms of human characteristics? Go ahead.
Because you can understand the animals trying to express their feelings and stuff.
Okay, yeah, it gives expression to things that normally don't have expression. You can understand the animals if they have feelings. Why else? Why is, going back to The Lion King, since you might know this story, why is it different when we have the story for, say, about a young lion who loses his father and has to overcome adversity to become king, as opposed to a person who loses his father and has to overcome adversity? What's the difference?
It'd be more entertaining.
Why?
Because littler kids like to see animals running around and things like that, I guess.
Okay, we do. I think we do have a natural human attraction to animals.
And you wouldn't exactly see a warthog like Pumbaa and Simba again. Who's a lion, kind of like.
Spitting at each other.
The lion would want to eat the warthog.
Normally. Okay, well, so turn around what you're saying, you think that maybe we see the animals having human characteristics so that they behave maybe in a better way than they normally would in the wild kingdom?
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying? Okay. And another thing that I think is important is that when we watch these beast fables, it's almost as if the story has been removed one level from reality. In other words, this is a frightening tale, but it's less frightening because it's happening to animals and it's not happening to a person. Can you imagine taking a small kid to seeing a movie in which the child is responsible or feels that he's responsible for his father's death? You see what I'm saying? I'm saying that that would be a little bit. It would be a little bit more frightening, a little bit too close to home, in that case. Well, beast fables have been around for a long time. You ever hear of a guy named Aesop?
No.
No? Well, he lived a long time ago, about the time of Christ, actually, and he wrote beast fables that have morals. Chaucer, who's about 1,000 years later, also wrote beast fables. And actually, did you know that Chaucer's One of his Canterbury Tales was the basis for Walt Wangren's Book of the Dun Cow. I didn't realize that until I went back and studied Chaucer again and found the Chanticleer story.
That's an Aesop fable.
Yeah,
grasshopper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that beast fables, like parables, are a puzzle. They're an exercise in meaning. When we see a beast fable, it's almost as if we want to say, okay, what does this mean? What does this stand for? You notice when we have beast fables, we have characteristics that are emphasized in the animals much more than you might think would occur in the wild kingdom. If I gave you some animals, for example, can you tell me what their characteristic is? What characteristics stand out?
Yeah.
Lion, for example.
Well, it likes to attack animals a lot.
Okay, but when you think of lion, what's the first quality that comes to your mind?
Big and strong.
Big and strong, yeah.
Oh.
King, right. King of the forest. Courageous. How about a fox?
Probably fast and keen, quick.
Okay, I would agree with those, although that's not the association I would normally see.
Usually think
sly, sneaky.
Sneaky, yeah. Sly.
Poisonous.
Yeah. Yeah, see, we have these cultural associations, don't we? We have these associations with animals that immediately come to mind when we talk about beast fables. And this is what authors are using. They have sort of a cultural ethos. There's another big word.
Yeah, like in the book The Hobbit, we have this band of homeless dwarfs, Bilbo Baggins, which is the Hobbit.
Okay.
And Gandalf. Now, those aren't exactly animals. How do they relate into the...
Well, that's more of a fantasy. You're getting ahead of me. But there is an element of beast fable in The Hobbit. Do you remember how they get away from the mountain? How they escape the orcs? The eagle dude guy. Yes, it is the eagle. And what do you normally associate with eagles? Because Tolkien makes use of that. Do you know?
Eagles are fast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they're far-sighted. Supposedly, they can see from a great distance. But yeah, you're getting ahead of me to fantasy. Really, the beast fables, more than I'm thinking of, are along the lines of E.B. White books. Have you read these? Charlotte's Web, Stuart
yeah,
Little?
No, I've read the others. I've read Charlotte's Web.
No, he's fine. Charlotte's Web, or have you heard of this one? This one might be a little bit older. This is Watership Down. Okay, this is about a story of some rabbits who essentially have to go on a journey from one place where it's going to be destroyed, their house is going to be destroyed, to another place and to find a safe place for them all to live. And this brings up the other element of beast fables. Why do you think rabbits, what would destroy the rabbits that would make them have to move? No, good guess.
You mean like a predator?
Well, no.
Overpopulation.
Overpopulation.
Yeah, you would think.
If they were living on a farm, this kind of sounds like letter strike herd. I'm trying to think.
What's wrong with them living on a farm and in a garden? Who would object?
The farmer
would object, exactly. Who do you think rabbit's biggest enemy is?
Hugh Foxton.
No, not fox.
Humans.
Humans, yes. At the beginning of the story, the place that's called a warren, but the place where the rabbits live is destroyed by humans who want to build a building. And it's destroyed rather gruesomely, too. The rabbits are drugged so that they would run out of their holes, and then they're caught or else shot. And it's a real gruesome experience. Fortunately, the rabbits that the story is about, one of them has foresight and sees this coming and brings some of them away. But others, we're told the story later of what happens to these rabbits. And this brings up the other point about beast fables. Beast fables is really a genre that allows us to look at ourselves from outside. In other words, we get the human point of view, or the rabbit point of view of humans. We see what humans look like from another point of view. And it's the same thing, too, with Charlotte's Web. You know, what's the problem with Wilbur?
He's
really scared that he's going to get, like, fattened up and turned into...
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There are all sorts of perils. At the beginning, he's a runt. Well, we can't have that. We've got to kill him, except Fern objects. Later on, you know, he's getting fattened up because...
That one rat keeps telling him, like, they're going to fatten you up and eat you for Christmas.
Right, exactly. And a pig's worst enemy is, again, humans. And in fact, I even know of another story where a character in the story reads Charlotte's Web and says, well, why do they want to kill the pig? And is told, well, the pig is essentially the sausage that you've eaten for breakfast. And thereafter, then, she never eats sausage again for breakfast, or bacon, or anything else that's made from pig's meat. I suppose when somebody comes and writes a story about cows, then the same thing might happen with cows. But that's the other character of Beast Fables. Beast Fables really allows us to explore what it means to be a human from other perspectives. And that's one thing that I find interesting. Well, Luke brought up a point on the Forum Tuesday night that I want to bring in at this point. You said, and see if I can get your words right, you said Holden Village is more real than what we term the real world. Okay, Holden Village is more real than what we term the real world. And I want to think about that. I want to ask exactly what we think of as the real world. Obviously, these books, these beast fables, are not what we might call real. You know, animals don't talk, or if they do, well, then, you know, maybe you need to be examined. Animals don't really talk, but on the other hand, we have to ask ourselves, you know, what exactly is real? What does it mean to be real? The theme for the summer, and I don't know if you have encountered this, but you have, I imagine. The theme for the summer is a foretaste of the feast to come, and I'd like to think of this in terms of Plato's ideal in a Christian expression. Do you guys know what Plato is, or I'm going to be talking to your parents here?
Plato.
No. No, it's not Plato. Plato.
Plato.
Plato. Well, in Plato's terms, and see if I can bring this home to you. In Plato's terms, this is not really a book. Okay, this is the manifestation of a book, but the real book is the book that's in our mind. You see what I'm saying? In other words, you have a concept of a book, you have an idea of a book, and that, because it's transferable, because it's more cultural than this particular book, that book holds more reality than this book. And I tend to think of reality in the same way. I mean, when I think of a foretaste of the feast to come, I think of our concept of what we experience here on Earth as being maybe something that is... I think of what we experience on Earth as something that is not necessarily as real as what we will experience maybe in heaven, or what we may will experience in the feast to come. Do you see how I'm tying this together? And now back to the beast fables. I think that this expresses a reality that is more real than what occurs in the real world. Do you see what I'm saying?
Because it's clearer and it's simpler.
Yes.
If you do line tea, you talk about an issue in a way that people can grapple with, mm-hmm. and think about. I don't know, I'm asking, I guess, make it more simpler.
Yeah, no, not necessarily in its simplicity. I tend to think that even fables have a deceptive depth to them. It's the type of thing where on the surface you see some meanings, and yet under the surface you see deeper meanings. And to maybe further explain what I mean, if you have ever gone to a Disney movie, have you seen the Disney movies with your children? There are levels of humor that the children don't get, and this is what I guess I see as various labels. I don't necessarily would say that it is more real because of its simplicity, but I think it's more real because it explains a relationship between us and creation that is not necessarily limited to a human point of view. In other words, humans, in Watership Down, we see humans in their dark side. They build, they destroy, and it has a devastating effect to a rabbit community. This is something that you won't see in a construction manual. You won't see this issue coming up when the developers are talking about, you know, where they're going to build. I don't necessarily want to say that this is a precursor to environmental issues. You know, I don't want to say beast fables should lead you to a better awareness of an animal kingdom. But I do want to say that beast fables at least tell us about ourselves. They show us that what we look like from the outside. And that's something that I think fantasy, if I could turn now to the other half of my presentation, I think fantasy does that as well. I think fantasy shows us our world by showing us a world that is an other, you know, not necessarily our world, but an other. The comment that I hear about Star Trek, again, here I'm finding examples not from literature, but from popular culture. Star Trek is not about the 24th century, is it? You know, it supposedly occurs in the 24th century, but Star Trek is about us. Star Trek is about what we do, our values as a culture, and not about the values of the culture in the 24th century. And I think the same is true for worlds that are created. You know, these worlds aren't necessarily other worlds. These are worlds that show us, maybe in other contexts. You really can't have, think about this, you can't have a fantasy book in which nothing is recognizable. You have to have some sort of recognition. Otherwise, the fantasy is too out there and you can't understand. And I think the recognition is grounded in our current society, in our current humanity. Oftentimes you will have, even in Beast Fables and in fantasy, Alice in Wonderland is a classic example, you will have the characters going from our world into the other world as sort of an extension of ourselves in the other world. Alice in Wonderland is one of the earliest examples of fantasy. This is a genre that really didn't exist more than 100 years ago. And as a fantasy, I think it's a little bit more disjointed than most fantasies are. Usually fantasies have worlds that are well-crafted, that have their own, really have their own characterization. As you guys have read The Hobbit, aren't you amazed at just this whole creation?
Yeah, I think that's it. How many J.R.R. Tolkien books have you read?
How many have I read? Gosh, more than he seems to have written. You know, when Tolkien died in 73, he had only really The Lord of the Rings, The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings published, with The Silmarillion about to be published. And since then, his son has edited all of his books and sort of brought this entire mythology, this entire creation
to light. I haven't exactly read, I'm not sure what book this is, but one of my friends that used to live where I did, his dad was reading this J.R.R. Tolkien book, and he told me about, I'm not sure what book it is, but J.R.R. Tolkien, he puts Jesus Christ sort of in the place of Gandalf, and he falls into the big pit and dies to save these guys, and then in the next book he comes back.
Well, I'm not sure if that's...
Is there a Christ figure?
Well, there is a Christ figure, Gandalf has sometimes been associated with Christ in that he does battle with evil. In the process, he sacrifices himself, and then he's brought back to life at a later point. And I suppose that's in the Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
That's where that occurs.
But Gandalf would never be associated with the Christ figure in the entire mythology of Tolkien's world.
Yeah.
That spot is reserved for someone completely different, as a matter of fact. In the world in which Tolkien is created, there is the One.
Mm-hmm.
And Gandalf is simply a messenger of the One and not a Christ at all.
Yeah.
So
there is the element of, I mean, dying and being brought back to life, but I don't think that it goes beyond that.
But your point is that there's different levels of understanding, and sometimes you can find that implications like that to help you understand.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. The different things that you would recognize, at least from our world, into the other ones. The thing about The Hobbit that just amazes me is that Tolkien, as he's writing this, he says in his letters that he doesn't see the act of writing as an act of creation, but he sees an act of writing as an act of discovery. Where he has to discover what happened to these characters. It's almost as if the creation is out there, and then he's a researcher trying to figure out exactly what's going on in this world. And he was really essentially, I don't want to say obsessed, that sounds unhealthy, but he spent the better part of his life discovering, if you will, what was going on in his world, and as a result, you have a world that is just rich in diversity, in creation. I mean, it has its own mythology. It has all of its characters. It really is a well-crafted world into itself. I'm not sure exactly how much people read the Tolkien books anymore. I'm very surprised to hear that you do. It used to be 20 years ago that a copy of Tolkien was on every college campus and in every dorm room, and I'm not sure that that's true anymore. Do any of you others have experience with Tolkien?
You have to, Dave, they're good.
All right.
Yeah,
I read it in junior high, and I don't know many people who read it.
Anymore?
My age, yeah. 29.
20 years ago here at Holden, they had an entire 2-week seminar on the Lord of the Rings and its meaning and mm-hmm. stuff like that.
Yeah, it is.
That's what it was 20 years ago.
It is a very wealthy book with regards to just its craft and what's in it. And I think it's also the precursor of all of the fantasy books that's written nowadays. Fantasy seems to have become more of an adult genre. You don't see too many children's books written in the fantasy genre anymore. But I do want to point out some that also have this just sense of craft. Since we do have a smaller group here, and I do have some time, I would like to read from some. This is called the Wizard of Earthsea Trilogy. You said you had heard of this. Yeah, and the first book of this is the Wizard of Earthsea. This is, again, another world that's just been crafted by a science fiction writer, essentially Ursula Le Guin. How do you pronounce this? Le Guin? And this is what I mean when I talk about recognition. I give this story to my students when I teach, because sometimes I don't know if they get the point that I'm trying to come across. The Wizard of Earthsea is all about power and about the relationship between humans and essentially the world around them. And it's written in a style. I'll get to your questions in a minute. It's written in a style that presents this as if it were a mythology of an older time. Earthsea is a world of, it's essentially an archipelago, a group of islands that's connected. And he writes this, or she writes this, story of a magician who goes on to become the greatest magician in this world, but not magician in the sense of doing tricks and performing and being a person of great power, but a magician in the sense of being a servant, being someone who understands the real delicate balance between power and its effects, and it's really quite well crafted novel. Before I read, go ahead. What do you want to say?
Have you ever read fantasies by Bruce Cobo?
No, I haven't.
Okay, because there's this one called Goblins in the Castle. And it's about a
boy, it kind of takes back in like the 1500s. It's about a boy who's, and he's in a castle that used to have goblins in it. And the king had this wizard cast a spell on the goblins, and the goblins were originally good, and they took care of houses and stuff, but the king thought they were bad, so he like kind of destroyed them and stuff and killed them.
It sounds like this is an author who's been reading his Tolkien.
Yeah, and the kid accidentally lets him free, and he finds kind of like a man down in a secret passage.
Bill, is that like a book you got at the school library or through the book club or something?
No, my mom got it for Christmas. I'm not sure.
I don't understand it, but there seemed to be a grouping now of, you know, leader book clubs, scholastic book clubs, you know, 98-page or 160-page fantasy books. The genre seems to have gotten there. I don't know.
Oh, has it?
I don't know. They're terribly well crafted. Mm-hmm. All these fantasy worlds are the same types of figures.
And yeah. Uh-huh.
In the J.R.R. Tolkien series, I know there's The Hobbit, and there's Lord of the Rings, and there's the second trilogy of the Two Towers. Are there any beyond that?
Yeah, the Lord of the Rings is the Fellowship of the Ring, the Two Towers, and the Return of the King. And that's essentially the Lord of the Rings story. And then if you want, you can also go back and discover the whole mythology, history of Tolkien's world, which he calls Middle-earth.
Yeah.
There's book after book. There's probably about 20 of them now, which is just all of his papers and just notes that he had about stories in the world and what's what. You could spend a good lifetime reading all of these things if you so choose. I'm sorry? Yeah. Now this is back to the Earthsea, and this is a story of the young. His name is Ged. And he's just become an apprentice to a local magician. And he had thought, Ged had thought that as apprentice of a great mage, he would enter at once into the mystery and mastery of power. He would understand the language of beasts and the speech of the leaves of the forest, he thought, and sway the winds with his word and learn to change himself into any shape he wished. Maybe he and his master would run together as stags or fly to Rhaelbi over the mountains on the wings of eagles. But it was not so at all. They wandered first down into the vale, and then gradually south and westward around the mountain, giving lodging in little villages or spending the night out in the wilderness like poor journeyman sorcerers or tinkers or beggars. They entered no mysterious domain. Nothing happened. The mage's oaken staff that Ged had watched at first with eager dread was nothing but a stout staff to walk with. 3 days went by and 4 days went by, and still Ogion had not spoken a single charm in Ged's hearing, and had not taught him a single name or ruin or spell. Though a very silent man, he was so mild and calm that Ged soon lost awe of him, and in a day or two more, he was bold enough to ask his master, "When will my apprenticeship begin, sir?" Said Ogion, "It has begun." There was a silence as if Ged was keeping back something he had to say. Then he said it, "But I haven't learned anything yet," replied the mage, "because you haven't found out what I'm teaching." And he went on a steady pace, long-legged, along the road, which was a high pass between Ovark and Wis. He was a dark man, like most Gauntish men, dark copper-brown, gray-haired, lean and tough as a hound, and tireless. He spoke seldom, ate little, slept less. His eyes and ears were very keen, and often there was a listening look on his face. Ged did not answer him. It was not always easy to answer a mage. "You want to work spells," Ogion said presently, striding along. "You've drawn too much water from that well. Wait. Manhood is patience. Mastery is 9 times patience. What is that herb by the path?" "Strawflower," replied Ged. "And that one?" "I don't know." "Forfoil, they called it." Ogion had halted. "It's staff near the little weed. Near the little weed, so Ged looked closely at the plant and plucked a dry seed pod from it, and finally asked, since Ogian said nothing more, "What is its true use, master?" "None that I know of," he replied. Ged kept the seed pod a while as they went on, and then tossed it away. Ogian said, "When you know the Forfoil in all of its seasons, root and leaf and flower, by sight and scent and seed, then you may learn its true name and knowing its being. Which is more than its use? What, after all, is the use of you, or myself? Is Gaunt Mountain useful, or the open sea?" Ogian went on a half mile or so, and then said at last, "To hear, one must be silent." Okay. Now, I really like this, because this, I think, is instructive just in the aspects, not in just what's going on in this world, but in our world as well. You know, to hear, one must be silent. And it's the same thing as, I think, you know, along all around in these mountains, you know, what is the use of this mountain? What is the use of this flower? What is the use of all of these things that we see along the trail today? Well, it's not necessarily what is its use, but what is its being? What is its essential being? And that's what I like in this book. It teaches that power lies in the name of things. It teaches that power is not something that is to be used lightly, but it is something that is within our care and something to take very seriously. Ged, who is the young magician of great skill in this book, must learn very severe, harsh lessons about use and the misuse of power, even before he gets to the first book. Other books that I have, Terran Wanderer is the fourth in the series of five books, which are the Chronicles of Pradyne. Pradyne is an epic that's rooted in Welsh mythology, whereas Tolkien uses primarily Anglo-Saxon Old English mythology. Lloyd Alexander uses Welsh mythology, and these also provide circumstances for them to create, to craft these worlds. And I want to close really by talking about this. I think that the act of creation is probably one of the greatest imitations that we have of the original creation. You know, God created so that we may further create. And it's in experiencing the creations here that again tell us, not these aren't about other worlds, these are about our worlds, and we see them from the outsider's point of view. But we can experience the creation of somebody who is essentially being the creator of these worlds. And in the experience of that creation, I think we can better experience our own creation. Well, any questions?
Yeah, comments? You said the fantasy genre is only about 100 years old.
Yeah.
It draws from mythology.
Right.
But mythology for other cultures would not have been fantasy.
Yeah, there's a real strong distinction between mythology and fantasy. I think of mythology in terms of Joseph Campbell. It's more of a public dreaming, is the way that Joseph Campbell describes mythology. Mythology is something that the public dreams, and it really has something to do with the inherent ethos of a culture, the inherent unwritten character of a particular culture. I see fantasy as one person's expression of a story, of a creation, rather than the continuation of a mythology. Now, there's no denying that there are heavy myths involved in these fantasies. I mean, if you can go back and look at the mythology in Welsh. Did I pronounce that right? The Eisteddfod,
in Wales.
Yeah, that is the origin of a lot of what the Chronicles of Pradyne deal with. But their utterance, their instance, is in Lloyd Alexander's book, and so I see that as a fantasy and not necessarily as.
Well,
as
I guess what I'm trying to say is, what's the shift about it? Why did all of a sudden we get the genre, and why all of a sudden did the cultural dream break into individual creations of fantasy? certain people always fantasize. I guess I would have that question too, because I used to like to read science fiction. Now I go to the science fiction store, section, bookstores, the bookstores, there's fantasy stuff.
And there's fantasy, yeah.
And it's a sort of creepy, a creepy phenomenon here. I'm wondering what's in that. Uh-huh. Man, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I've experienced the same thing. I don't know if that I can. I haven't kept up enough to. There's some fantasies that I just can't take. After a while, they all start seeming the same.
Well, the book cover all the same, you know.
I think the answer though lies in something that you said, and that is that the genre gives us meaning about ourselves, and there are different levels of meaning, and then there are authentic meaning and sometimes inauthentic meaning that people get. And the farther people get away from things that are authentic, the more they hunger and thirst for these things that are not authentic, but give their lives meaning. Some of the folks that I've encountered that are heavy into fantasies, I work with teenagers and so forth, are people whose lives are very disconnected from what is actually happening. You know, because in some senses what is actually happening to them is either so horrible or somehow so boring, or, you know, there are a variety of reasons for that. Mm-hmm. But they're searching for some kind of meaning. Mm-hmm. And in this fantasy genre, they find it. In a sense, you know, if we're actually talking about what we as Christian community are about, part of what we have to do is we have to talk about meaning in ways that people find authentic meaning, rather than having to search in these strange and bizarre books, mm-hmm. In strange and bizarre worlds, which in some cases are helpful and some are not.
Mm-hmm. So, I guess the question is, what is it about that genre? You look at Dungeons and Dragons, which is a play-out fantasy,
right.
Or Magic Cards, like these guys are doing now. I don't know if you're doing Magic Cards or not, but mm-hmm. it's a crafting of a world and participating in it as well as reading it, but science fiction was sort of the same. No?
I think it has to do with the construction of a certain kind of future for yourself, or the construction of escape world or something else. And those folks who wrote even 50 years ago about the escape to utopia probably could describe much better than we can people who wrote, you know, for example, like 1984, George Orwell, or Walden II, B.F. Skinner, you know, some of these other folks have described for us what happens when somebody tries to escape into a utopian world and finds out that what happens in that utopian world is not very much different than what happens in our world. Except with the science fiction genre, there are continuing battles with evil that you can continue to fight and succeed and so forth vicarious through these characters. And so you do construct a world that has happy endings and is different than the world in which we live.
I do think the popularity of fantasy lies in the dichotomy between what is recognizable and what is distanced. There has to be the element of recognizable. Something that doesn't have anything recognizable in it is not going to have the appeal. But yet with the fantasy, the things that might be threatening are displaced and therefore less threatening. You know, when you look at something that's futuristic and you see humanity, recognizable humanity, but yet humanity that is displaced, you think that is a possible future, let's move in this direction. But it's also in the recognition that you find an examination of yourself. Back to your question about science fiction versus fantasy, I guess the fantasy... I guess science fiction is a particular form of fantasy that deals more with a fantasy of what is to come rather than a fantasy of what maybe may have been. Tolkien is very clear in thinking of Middle Earth as something that has happened in our past. Humans have evolved beyond the humans that exist in his type of story. And that occurs largely in other fantasies as well. You won't see in fantasy characters or cultures that are scientifically equivalent, technologically equivalent of our everyday culture. It's usually more of a primitive culture, a primitive understanding. But I can't say exactly why the appeal for science fiction has shifted to fantasy, or even if it's a healthy shift.
Well, that's helpful to me, I mean, because science fiction is about the future, it's about complexity, complexifying of life and what that leads you to, whereas fantasy seems to be swords and spells and simple. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean simple, probably not important, but more basic.
Mm-hmm. It's escape, basically. Yeah. What it is. It's an escape from what you have to face. For a lot of the kids that read it, that I think.
But I would argue too that some science fiction, again using Star Trek as the classic example because that's an industry in and of itself, Star Trek has limits to its vision of the future. Originally, Gene Roddenberry wanted to see a future in which everybody gets along. Unfortunately, the realities of 20th century TV is that you have no plot devices then. If everybody gets along, you can't have any storylines, and the writers fought with him about this. And so as a result, we still have to have the demonization of the other, but the other in this case takes the form of the other culture. In the original series, the other was the Klingons and the Romulans, where we throw them as the evil that we encounter. In the current series, you have the other in the form of the Dominion. It's like we can't get away from the other. And as far as I'm concerned, really it's the humanity in which we have to confront our evil. It's almost as if the science fiction has thrust the evil all into the other and tried to cleanse us of what we have. And it seems to me, you know, the biggest fear that people had in the 40s and 50s about Martians before we knew anything was that they were going to come and conquer us. And my response is that why in the world would an alien race want to conquer us? I mean, we are a fallen world. We are a world where people can't get along. We can't take care of what we've been given. It seems to me that were there cultures that existed outside of our world, they would take one look at us and say, why are we worth the bother? And this is the attitude that C.S. Lewis has explored in his space trilogy, in that what occurs on the Earth is not the monster. I'm sorry, what occurs outside is not the monster, but what occurs on the Earth is. And that the solar system in C.S. Lewis's mythology has trouble understanding what goes on in the silent planet, the Earth being the silent planet, the one that does not participate in the harmony of the universe.
Is that you
guys jumping? That's actually an old middle medieval mythology.
Is that why you grouped the anthropomorphic stories of fantasy together? Because it's
essentially it's one way of
they're all aspects of ourselves, whereas
exactly
instead of casting out of ourselves the evil, making casual.
Yeah, it's one way of looking. It's really a way of looking at ourselves from the outside. The stories that I focused on 2 days ago were stories that were grounded more in the everyday experience of children, children being children. And these are stories that are more grounded in children or humans, because these are more for older people, encountering or being described in terms of what's around them, looking from the outside in.
You know, Greg, there was a Tolkien craze a generation ago, and
it's exactly what we were saying.
Right, and I'm wondering, in Tolkien today, the question is, since you're doing something on fantasy, was that Ursula Le Guin that you were?
Yes.
What is the craze for people who do read fantasy today? What are they reading? And then my question is, the connecting question is, well, why was there such a hunger for and such a fascination with Tolkien when everybody was reading Tolkien? And whatever they're reading today, why is there an interest in that today?
Yeah, I honestly cannot tell you what they're reading today. It seems to me that the most popular fantasy books that I've seen are Pierce Anthony fantasies. And these are not as well crafted. Although he's created a world that in my mind is largely trivial His word is world is called Xanth, Xanth, and it's essentially a world of magic. And in some ways, it's a lot like Tolkien, but the magic is trivial. He writes more for the wordplay and the pun than for the craft of the story, and he really engages in a lot of juvenile, adolescent male fantasy. Essentially, women are described in voluptuous terms, and the men are it's more of a He-Man type of mythology that I really don't care for as much. But he's at the top of his the fantasy genre nowadays. I'm not exactly sure what his appeal is because it doesn't appeal to me, so I'm the wrong person to ask. But I do know that there is a decline in interest in Tolkien now.
Yes.
And I'm not sure exactly why. I'm wondering if it goes back to college campuses, because Tolkien used to be just a real hot thing on college campuses, and it's not now. And it may be a result. We can blame everything on the 80s if we want to. It may be a result of just a more seriousness. People who aren't into as much of the escapist, the counterculture aspect of it that so appealed to the children in the 60s and 70s.
Do you think that's what the primary appeal was, an escapism, or do you think it was... See, some people that I know that read it because they said, finally here was a world where there was order and where values were, where the transcendent, whatever that is, was, again, experienceable, and that you could breathe. There was breathing space here, and you didn't have this flattening out of reality into only that which is scientifically observable and understandable.
You're talking about an adult audience, I suppose, but as I notice my kids and the older ones, I think that's very much a factor. There's boundaries, there's rules, there's limits. You can understand the system here. And not only is that in the literature, but it's in the spin-offs that come from that media. And the genre now, I think, of fantasy has indeed gone multimedia here. I mean, it's books. And a lot of the books that are being written on the basis of the computer games or the basis of rhythm, as well as vice versa. But I think that's a real issue. As I observe with my kid, I think it's a real issue. We know how this works. Here's the rules, and it's good against evil, and you got to fight chance here.
Look, 20 years ago. In other words, there's a clarification. Excuse me, just to follow up on there to make sure I'm hearing you. You're saying, you're agreeing and saying there is something about this fantasy world which gives order and coherence to our world, which is pretty chaotic in terms of moral values.
Whether it's done through escape or whether it's actually happening, I don't know. But for Paul, I think it's a positive or negative difference for me. But yeah, the kids enter into that, there is a clarity. I would like to see them bring that, in a good mythological sense, bring that clarity out and apply it to their daily lives. But I don't think that's happening all the time. I think sometimes you just do the escape because that's the only ordered place there is to go. And I think that's the phenomenon I'm observing.
But nobody knows about how transfer goes.
That's true.
No, and where would we be without that?
Yeah.
And also, it might be a way in which the humanization of the children takes place that is like a John the Baptist function, namely preparing the way for even hearing a more serious word.
Yeah.
But
see, 20 years ago, that was the only game in town, Tolkien, right?
Right.
One of the few games. Now you have so varied. You're messing with a lot of different authors, different series. I see kids in my junior high where I teach reading all kinds of different things.
Yeah.
Few do read The Hobbit. I see that. But there's just more there to see.
Well, I do know back when I took a course, Literature for Adolescents, The Hobbit was the assigned reading, and it was the least favorite of all of them. I mean, we'd read a bunch of works for the adolescent age group, and when we took a poll at the end of the semester, the people who had read it felt that The Hobbit was much too convoluted and too, I almost want to say too orderly. You know, the real world isn't like this, that type of thing. Go ahead.
Man, the thing I've noticed about science fiction is that it used to be sort of like the good guys against the bad guys. There's nothing in between. It's sort of like when Star Trek, they released the original series, it was sort of the Klingons against the Federation. There's nothing in between there. But then, as it got on to the next generation, where they had that Captain Picard and those guys, they had made a treaty with the Klingons, and their son still want to fight and things. It's sort of the same as Star Wars. In the first two Star Wars, it's sort of the Empire against the Rebels. But then when Luke finds out that one of the leaders of the Empire is his father, then it sort of gets sort of shaky, whether who's the good guys and the bad guys.
So the genre is becoming much more complex then, as it's not,
yeah,
not
just, it's
not in black and white anymore.
The humans against the aliens.
So which do you prefer? Is this which seems more real to you, or which is more helpful to read, or more fun?
Well, I think I'd probably like more when it's not the good guys against the bad guys, because that's sort of not as mysterious, and you don't. I mean, it's just sort of not very. You sort of know what's going to happen next.
It's very obvious.
You don't know whether it's a one that was a savage and doesn't believe in the treaty anymore. But if it's just, you know, they're the bad guys, and there's nothing mysterious or.
I don't think it's surprising in a society that continues to value data over decisiveness. That is to say, in order to make any decision, you have to have as much data at your fingertips as you possibly can. Our society has been that. It has developed that tendency over the past 50 years. And the impossible thing about that is that in this day and age of information transfer, everything that is said, including the things that we're saying now, are being taped and probably will eventually be transcribed and will be held in some data bank somewhere. And data is increasing so rapidly that to know enough to make a competent decision now takes so much knowledge and so much specialty that, as some people have said, we're becoming more and more specialized, that pretty soon we're going to know absolutely everything about nothing at all. You know, and in that society, we have become indecisive. It is almost impossible for us to have enough data to make a decision, and we're paralyzed. In these fantasy books, they don't need the data. Their decisions are made instantaneously with the swipe of a sword or the whip of a wand, and it's decisive. And I think that perhaps that's something that we're thirsting for, is the decisiveness of action. And you wonder if that's not a figure in all of this. I don't know.
But I would argue that fantasy works, I don't think, are as simple as being things being decided by the slice of the sword. I mean, if a fantasy world is well crafted enough, then it's incredibly complex.
Yeah. Things aren't
in ways that are.
But people are decisive.
Okay.
And I think it's probably not fair, but in the way we've constructed the conversation, there's good fantasy and there's bad fantasy out there. That's the reality too. And I think the bad fantasy takes the decisiveness and that to an extreme. And that's part of the order, I think. Rich Mailheim, to Luther Patrick, with the confirmation ministry, just describes kids now being the age of handheld power. And says you don't like the TV channel, you push the button. You know, sort of ads go from 60 seconds to 30 seconds to 15 seconds. And you know, if you want to escape, you open the garage door. If you want to do this to the computer, if you don't like kids at school, you pull the trigger. You know, and the decisiveness of the age again is you can solve things with a push of a button or triggers. And I think fantasy has some of that in it.
For what I would call bad fantasy.
Yeah.
Well, and those computer games, I mean, they are quick decision games. You do not have time to sit around and say, weigh option A and option B and all the data involved. You have to make a quick decision and go, and that's it.
And I don't mean to shove the discussion, Greg, but I mean, for me, the phenomenon of the fantasy, that's why I asked, is a new genre. Mm-hmm. And even though my son reads, you know, he's got a lot of other inputs, and the genre is coming through from a lot of media other than just books. And you grew up at home with just books. The kids aren't grown up either at home or with just books anymore. Mm-hmm. And I'm fortunate that I feel the parent fortunate, at least part of the input's coming through reading. Mm-hmm. But I think fantasy for me sort of brings a lot of those issues together.
Well, if you're looking for good fantasy, I have all of these to recommend. I said something about the Earthsea trilogy. I said something about the Perdine and the Tolkien fantasy. Lewis and Carroll's Alice in Wonderland was pretty self-explanatory. The one that I didn't talk about was the Darkest Rising sequence. This is more of a Merlin. It deals with the Merlin mythology, but it deals with it again in a new way that I don't think is necessarily mythological, but fantasy. A young boy is born to what is called the circle of old ones that are responsible for the care of the world, and they, while the book is crafted, I'm reminded of this. We talked about things crafted in terms of black and white, and the old ones versus the forces of evil is crafted in black and white. But in between these is essentially our world that is caught in this struggle, and this is sort of a blending of the fantasy that is grounded in history. This is sort of like the Lewis books that the science fiction Out of the Silent Planet, that series, in that it puts our world in a larger context. And again, like these others, I think it's well crafted the way that she creates her own mythology with rhymes, sequences, and this little charm on the back that pervades through the whole book. When the dark comes rising, six shall turn it back, three from the circle, three from the track, wood, bronze, iron, water, fire, stone, five will return, and one go on alone. It's very, ominous, and you wonder what that means, and essentially the explanation is through all five books. That was the other one that I brought today. I didn't get as many from upstairs as I could have. I don't know if anybody has any other fantasy.
I don't know if you put the Narnia Chronicles in that.
Yes, I would. I'm saving the Narnia Chronicles for tomorrow, though.
I thought you
talked about gospel. Yeah.
Do you see any fantasy in the Bible, Craig? Like in the apocalyptic? Do you think that as a kind of a analogy and analog to fantasy?
I haven't honestly read it closely enough to be able to make that judgment.
We can't convince people it's mythology in the Bible. Don't ask us to make them believe there's fantasy in the Bible. We'll get hung for sure.
Well, my thesis is that apocalyptic is a kind of fantasy that takes us out of this world to bring us back into this world. And I wonder if, in an interesting way, in another God-earth way, Jesus' parables don't function this way. So I'm just curious if you've thought about that.
Well, and along those lines, if you understand them one way, that's one thing. But if you understand them another way, there's more truth in them than there is in most daily newspapers. And the same thing is true, as a matter of fact, of Aesop's Fables. There's more truth in every one of Aesop's Fables than there is in any edition of the New York Times.
And it goes back to my point, which I don't know if you were here for or not, when I said that one of the questions that you have with fantasy is, what exactly is the real world?
Mm-hmm.
What is the idea of reality? That's why I brought Plato in, is that in some of these, the world is more real than the world we actually experience in just that interaction. I was reminded of that when Luke said, as part of the forum on Holden kids growing up, that in Holden we seem to have more real relationships with each other than we do in the so-called quote-unquote real.
You know, Marvin Lazarus has been doing a series on Blake, and Blake is really big on the fact that the word is performative.
Yes.
And to help people
performative utterance, yeah.
When he's taught, right, performative utterance, to help people understand that he said, the performative utterance is Genesis 1, when God says
let there be light.
And there is light. And in a sense, what's so great about fantasy, I think, is that it is magnificent performative utterance. Mm-hmm. It creates a world.
Yes.
And it's a world that, I never think of it as really escape, but maybe for a lot of people it is. I think it is a world in which you can come back, I like how you put it, you come back to this world and see a world in a new way.
Yeah, well, of course, what Blake would say is that rather than reading the world, me reading the world that you created, I should go out and create my own world, and we should all actually exist in the world of creating and not necessarily in the world of reveling. And I think actually...
Well, Blake is...
but that gets to the point, too, where it's not an escape. I mean, if you are creating the world, then it's not an escape for you. It's an expression of creation.
Yes.
It's an imitation of the creation.